Harbor, signed by...
Call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. It's 9 o'clock. Reminder that all cell phones should be turned off. This morning we have with us Co-Chairman Stedman, Senator Huggins, Senator Dyson, Senator Thomas, and Senator Elton. Today's meeting, we have an overview of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and we are under somewhat of a time constraint. We want to complete the business of the committee by 9:45, since there is another meeting that's going to be taking place. And we would invite any questions while we're having the presentation. We have Mr. Jeff Jesse, the Chief Executive Officer from the Trust, going to be making the presentation. Can you come up to the table, please? We have handout two documents for the committee. We have a copy of the Legislative Fiscal Analyst's overview out of the Ledge Finance booklet, and we also have a copy of the Senate Bill 51, an act making the appropriations and operating capital expenditures for the mental health program. Before we proceed, Senator Stedman, do you have any questions?
No.
Any questions from the rest of the members? Seeing none, please proceed, Mr. Jesse.
Okay, good.
Identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. I'm Lorraine Durr. I am the vice chair of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and I'm also finance chair. Jeff always likes to have a little support when he comes to do these things, so since I live here in Juneau, I told him I'd come and support him this morning. Since there are some people that haven't been through the review of the Mental Health Trust Authority, sometimes we do a real depth and real in-depth presentation. This morning, Jeff's going to do an overview in light of the time and giving you some other information. So, and then if there is time at the end, he has a video on the housing trust that he would like to show. So, Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and I am aware of your time constraints, and I'll make sure that we're concluding before 9:45. Appreciate this opportunity.
Before we do get started, we have I'd like to recognize Representative Andrea Dahl. She's in the audience.
Great. Thank you. If you pull out your slides, the first slide says the trust, a history of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Let me, if you turn to the first slide about territorial days, here's what happened. In territorial days, Alaska had what could only be described as a barbaric mental health system. If you had any mental disability, didn't matter if it was a mental illness, a developmental disability like mental retardation, Alzheimer's disease or related dementia, chronic alcoholism, you were actually arrested and tried for a federal crime of being an insane person at large. You didn't have to have done anything wrong, just have had a mental disability and come to the attention of the territorial officials because you couldn't take care of yourself in the community. A federal marshal would put you on an airplane and fly you to Morningside Hospital in Oregon, where you would serve a life sentence for the status of having a mental disability. When we were looking at statehood, this actually became a pretty significant issue and actually held up statehood, which very few people today recall. The reason is that the would-be state had no visible means of supporting, even paying for the Morningside program in Oregon, let alone developing our own mental health program here in Alaska. And so they spent several years looking at how they were going to resolve this issue. If you look at the slides entitled Barriers to Statehood, you see the other thing that happened was that when they started talking about building a mental health facility in Alaska, The Washington Post actually ran a banner headline on an article back east that said Siberia, USA. And remember, this is the late 50s. The tagline here was that somehow the United States was planning to build a gulag in the frozen north of Alaska, and they were going to send dissidents up here. And so this stirred things up in Congress. No doubt this was sort of promoted by those that had some concerns about statehood. So this was the kind of environment that we were working in at statehood. If you turn to the next page about the Enabling Act of 1956, they ended up with a three-pronged strategy to try to resolve this mental health issue. The first was some capital dollars to build the original wing of API. We also purchased the motel in Valdez that became the Harborview Developmental Center. Now, why did we buy a motel in Valdez for people with developmental disabilities? Well, Governor Egan was from Valdez, and this was an effort to try to get some employment support for that community. The second part of the Enabling Act provided some operating dollars to fund the operation of API and Harborview, but it diminished every year over 8 years in order to wean us off of the federal dole. And the final part of this three-legged stool was to take a lesson from the land trust that had been set up for the university and for the schools and create the first and only, no doubt the last, mental health land trust in the United States. The state was entitled to select 1 million acres of land to hold in trust to generate income to pay for Alaska's mental health program. It's notable that the legislature was actually appointed under the Enabling Act as the trustee of this 1 million acres of land, and we'll see in a minute how that developed over time. Now, if you turn to the slide that talks about early land trust management, one thing that you can certainly say is the state did an excellent job in selecting this 1 million acres of land. Homer Spit, Kenai River frontage, parts of the Chugach State Forest, Beluga coal fields, big trees around Haines. In southeast Alaska, the mental health trust lands looked like donuts. They surrounded most of the communities in southeast. And the theory was sound, that as Alaska grew, mental health needs would increase, the lands would increase in value, they would generate more revenue to pay for the additional mental health services. Unfortunately, when the state received 100 million acres of land through the Statehood Act, they just rolled this 1 million acres into that 100 million. And over the next couple of decades, the state treated the mental health trust lands just like they would general state lands. And so over that period of time, half of that 1 million acres was taken out of the trust. We gave the big trees around Haines to the bald eagles and created the Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve. We awarded less than fair market value coal leases. We sold timber at less than market value. Individual Alaskans got pieces of trust land through homesteading provisions, land lotteries, you name it. Eventually 5,000 individual Alaskans ended up with pieces of mental health trust lands. We used to call them the moms and the pops. Now, how did this all sort of come unraveled? Well, it came unraveled in the late 70s. When local governments were entitled to select state lands for local uses in the same way that the state had selected these lands from the federal government. And so when local governments started looking at what lands they wanted to select from the state and went down to record their title, they discovered that almost 25% of the lands they had selected were mental health trust lands. Now remember, the 1 million acres was only 1% of the total land involved, but because of how it was selected originally, you can see why it became a much larger percentage of the land that was selected by local governments. Well, local governments came to the legislature in 1979 and said, look, our lawyers are telling us that we don't have good title to this land. It's trust land, We aren't paying anything for it. We need to have a solution to this so that we can get good title to this land. And in 1979, the legislature passed a law that redesignated that entire 1 million acres of trust land as general state land. Now, you had lawyers as well, and your lawyers told you that you couldn't just do that. You had to pay for this 1 million acres. So the legislature set up a mental health trust income account into which it pledged to put 1.5% of the revenue from all state lands into this account to pay for mental health services. Well, the legislature never made any deposits. Well, it only took the mental health advocates 3 years to figure out there was something wrong with this. And so they ended up going to Fairbanks, and they found a lawyer who was interested in making a name for himself, and Steve Cooper filed the original Mental Health Lands Trust lawsuit. Governor Cooper has an interesting history with the trust. In 1979, he was in the legislature and voted to take the land. In 1982, he filed the lawsuit to get it back. And as governor, he would later preside over 2 failed settlement attempts. So as you see, many Alaskans have had a long and involved history with the Mental Health Lands Trust. Well, again, the lawsuit was filed in 1982. By 1985, the Alaska Supreme Court issued its decision. Interestingly, for a case that was as far-reaching as the Mental Health Lands Trust decision was, it only took the Supreme Court 3 pages in order to render a decision. If you look in the on the slide called litigation, you'll see that when the Supreme Court ruled on this, they went back to private trust principles, and the decision was pretty straightforward. What they said was this was a trust set up by the federal government. The legislature was appointed as trustee. By redesignating the land but not paying for it, they had breached their trust responsibility. The remedy is the remedy applied to any breaching trustee that absconds with trust property. You have to return the property. Well, that wasn't really going to be feasible. Again, we had Eagles on it. We had 5,000 individual Alaskans on it. Local government wanted to get their pieces of it. We had existing coal leases and other activities that were going on trust lands that couldn't be unwound. And so what resulted was, and some of you that were involved in this, is over a decade of negotiations over how to resolve this mental health lands trust issue. In the meantime, of course, much of this land was frozen by an injunction. And so there was certainly an economic impact as development on these lands was held up by the litigation. Along the way, one of the things the court did was define our beneficiaries. If you look on the slide called Beneficiaries Defined, you'll see that the beneficiaries of the Mental Health Trust include people that are mentally ill, chronic alcoholics, developmentally disabled, or people with Alzheimer's or related dementias. So when you look at our budget, you'll start to see how our recommendations and our expenditures track services for these beneficiaries. If you look on the settlement attempts page, I won't go through all of these, but you can see the various attempts that were made to try to settle the Mental Health Lands Trust case. If you turn to the slide that starts 1994, Settlement at Last, let me go over briefly how we ended up settling this issue. First of all, the land. Well, we knew we could get back half of the original land, but we wanted to get back to a 1 million acre land trust. That was the original intent of Congress. And many of the beneficiaries believed that having a land base devoted to development and economic activity was in our best interest. So what we did is we gathered together a group of stakeholders, the environmentalists, the developers, the coal miners, local governments. We pulled them all into a room and we said, hey, let's come up with a replacement list of 500,000 acres to make this trust whole. And we were able to do that. When we got to sensitive issues like timber, and the environmental community was not interested in timber being cut in pristine areas of forest, We looked to areas where there was already logging underway, Thorn Bay, Icy Cape. Actually, this worked quite well for the trust because those areas already had the infrastructure in place, log transfer facilities, roads, other types of facilities that would assist in the development of that resource. So we were able to put together close to 1 million acres of land that would then be managed by the Department of Natural Resources in a separate office called the Trust Land Office that would operate under trust principles as opposed to general state land management principles. This, of course, the land that we got back wasn't as valuable as the original 1 million acres, so there needed to be a cash component to the settlement. Eventually, we agreed on $200 million. That plus the principal that's been generated by the land office, inflation proofing, and our reserve are all managed by the permanent fund. Our funds are commingled with the permanent funds. We pay our share of expenses and then take our share of the profit or, in some cases, losses as the permanent fund goes forward. Now, of course, the most important part from our standpoint was how are we going to actually manage the income that comes from this resource. If you turn to the second settlement page, you'll see that the most important thing that we got out of the trust was to have the Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees created. And their job was to act as a trustee of the trust, and to be able to use the income and revenue from the land and the cash in order to improve mental health services in the state of Alaska. One of the other things that we did in the settlement that will be of particular interest to this committee is what had happened to our mental health program over the many years since statehood is we had separated various parts of it out and created a number of silos. So, for example, senior services for a long time were actually moved over to a different department. They were in the Department of Administration. Alcohol services got a separate division. Mental health and developmental disabilities were put into a division. What we realized is that by separating out all these various service systems, budgetarily and programmatically, we were not developing a comprehensive and integrated mental health program for the state. And so the settlement created a separate appropriation bill that is passed by the legislature that combines the budget components from all of these various areas serving the beneficiaries into one bill. It also includes capital, which makes it also unusual. So you can actually get a complete look at our comprehensive integrated mental health program budget by looking at the mental health bill. And that was the intent of the structure of the settlement. In addition, the Department of Health and Social Services was assigned the task in conjunction with the Trust Authority to develop a comprehensive integrated mental health plan. Now, if you have a chance to look at that plan, we actually are working very hard on this, and I'll tell you why this plan is so important. The reason the plan is so important is that is where our benchmarks and performance measures are reflected. It's what we manage to as we look at how to evolve the mental health program. One of the things the trustees have been very sensitive to from the very beginning of their efforts has been accountability and a focus on results. At the very first meeting, one of the trustees asked, well, how are we going to know what we get for the beneficiaries' money that we spend? And I'll never forget the providers that stood up and people from the department and said, oh, we've got all kinds of data. We can tell you how many people we served, how many units of service we provided. We've got all kinds of data. And this trustee looked at him and said, you know, all that tells me is that you spent all the money. I know you're going to spend all the money. What I want to know is if it's a housing program, how many people got housing? How many people still had that housing at 6 months, a year? If it's an employment program, how many people got a job? How many people still had that job in 6 months or a year? If it's a treatment program, how many people got better? How many people got better and stayed better? And so that comprehensive plan is where we put these indicators, and we operate that like a dashboard on your car. And we constantly monitor those indicators and then make adjustments to not only the program service delivery system, but the budget as well, as we try to influence how the mental health program is serving the people of the state of Alaska. Now, I won't go into it too much today, but you'll have other opportunities during the session to look at Bring the Kids Home. As you know, we have 400 kids out of state. Actually, I believe we're down to about 360. We're actually making some progress there. But same thing there. You'll see a lot of emphasis on getting indicators that will tell us whether the efforts that we're making and the investments that we're committing are actually getting results on the ground. So moving on to, you can see the trust mission statement. I won't read that to you. You can look at the trust authority roles. Again, just to quickly go over those, what the trustees do is they monitor the activities of the land office and the permanent fund, although frankly the permanent fund corporation doesn't need a whole lot of watching. But you know, we certainly do pay attention to what they're doing. I will mention this because I think it's a topic that comes up around the permanent fund as well, and that is, well, how do the trustees allocate the revenue that comes in from the permanent fund? The trustees realized very early on that if they just spent what they made every year, some years they would have tons of funding. Other years they would have nothing to spend, depending on how the permanent fund performed. So very early, they moved to an endowment model or a percentage of market value model, and they actually take a percentage of that endowment every year, and that's the funding that they use to fund mental health programs. Now, we started originally at 3% of the balance. One thing they realized as well is, remember, we're a perpetual trust, so we cannot go into the principal. Well, that meant we needed an income reserve. So for years when the permanent fund didn't generate positive income, we had a reserve fund from which we could make this payout. We hired Callan & Associates, the same people that advised the permanent fund, and they recommended that we put four times our annual payout into this income reserve so that when the permanent fund had difficulty making a positive return in a given market cycle, we were able to make the payout. This has turned out to be a brilliant strategy. In the late 90s, when the market had a significant downturn and the permanent fund actually lost money for several years, the trustees were able to make a continuing payout from this reserve without any significant reduction in funding to the program. That's critical because the trustees make multiple year commitments on occasion in order to ensure that projects that take longer to come into effect are able to be operated. By the way, the reserve went down to about 158% from 400. Which is the target. And then what we do is as that reserve hits that 400% mark, then we raise the payout. Now, every time you raise the payout a little bit, you have to add more to the reserve to cover it. And we're currently all the way up to 4%. Now, I know there's been talk about a permanent fund going to 5%. At this point, the trustees don't believe 5% is sustainable. The ultimate percentage payout is likely to be somewhere between 4.5% and 4.75%. But again, this enables the trustees to have a consistent level of funding, which they then can project their needs over time and know that they will have the funding available to meet their obligations. Moving on to the...
Mr. Chair, one question, if I could. Your last bullet on trust authority roles, separate yes. Mental health budget bill and the recommendation to the governor and the legislature, have you already done that this year?
Yes.
And what's your milestone for that?
You mean in terms of a performance measure?
Well, no, your time schedule.
Senator Huggins, through the chair, statutorily we're required to provide that on September 15th.
Okay.
And the way that works is the trustees on September 15th forward our recommendations to both the legislature and the executive branch. Now, an interesting part of that process is if either the executive branch, the governor, or the legislature fail to follow the recommendations made by the trustees. Now, that's both as to general funds as well as how trust funds might be spent through state government. The governor and the legislature are required to write the trustees a letter and explain why they differed from what the trustees recommended. This is an underutilized part of the trust settlement. Frankly, generally, those letters are pretty perfunctory. They pretty much say, gee, we don't have enough money to do everything, so we didn't fund everything you wanted. But it actually is an opportunity for a lot more policy dialogue between both of those branches of government and the trustees. So, for example, this body could, through that letter, identify for the trustees what your budget priorities are, what direction you want to see the mental health program go, and then the trustees would be able to take that information and use it to modify their recommendations in subsequent years. So I would really encourage you to look at that as an opportunity to provide feedback to the trustees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Senator Huggins. Please proceed.
Let me move on at this point to, since we've covered the recommendations process and the separate appropriation bill, just quickly, let's go to the slide called Beneficiaries by the Numbers, just to give you an idea of the order of magnitude of what we're trying to accomplish. As you can see, 8.5% of Alaskans 18 and over have a serious mental illness. 1 in 10 Alaskans are over 65, and nearly half of those over 85 have Alzheimer's disease. I will point out that, and I think you've heard this testimony in other places, the Pioneer Homes, for example, are more and more moving towards serving a greater proportion of people with Alzheimer's disease or related dementias. And that's going to become much more of an issue as we move forward into looking at long-term care planning for the state of Alaska. Over 11,000 Alaskans have developmental disabilities, and 15% of all Alaskans aged 18 to 25 are heavy drinkers. And I know I don't have to tell anyone at this table how critical the alcohol issues are to the welfare of the state of Alaska. Going on to the next slide of the focus area, justice for persons with disabilities, let me tell you how the trustees have evolved their strategy around the mental health program. For the first few years, it would be safe to say that the trustees were trying to get a lot done across a lot of different areas, and they realized that that kind of a shotgun approach probably wasn't the most effective way of getting major change in the system. So what they've done is they've now focused on five specific areas where they're trying to get significant movement over a period of time. So they've committed to these focus areas for anywhere from 4, 5, 6 years, depending on how long it takes us to get there. And the first one of those is justice for persons with disabilities. As you can see, 37% of people in corrections suffer from a mental illness. The Department of Corrections is the single largest mental health service provider in the state. And that percentage of people in corrections is much higher than in many other states. And so what the trustees are doing is looking at how we can impact that at all three levels of the justice system. At the front end, when you look at therapeutic courts, mental health courts, trying to take repeat, particularly misdemeanor offenders, and instead of just cycling them back through the justice system, getting them into case management, getting them into housing, getting them into treatment, and getting them out of that cycle The court system has become huge advocates of this because, again, we did specific evaluations of those programs, and the court system has seen the dramatic reduction in the recidivism of people that have gone through these therapeutic courts, particularly the mental health court. And we're now in the process of working to expand and replicate that system in other places. We were able to have a very good conversation with Commissioner Schmidt at Corrections. He's very interested in looking again at what we can do while people are in DOC to provide treatment and get them ready to be successful when they leave corrections. And then, of course, the biggest thing is when they leave corrections, are we getting them into services? Are we getting them stabilized? Are we getting them supported so they don't reoffend and end up back in the system? I want to just very briefly point out the Department of Corrections has done an incredible thing with the Social Security Administration, two huge bureaucracies working together. You know, it used to be when somebody came out of corrections, they weren't Medicaid eligible because they lost that eligibility when they went into jail or into the prison. And it would take months for people to get back onto benefits. Now they pre-qualify people before they leave corrections, a huge benefit. Moving on to housing. I'm actually going to leave housing for a minute and come back to this video in about 2 minutes. Let's go on to bring the kids home. And again, I will just very briefly let you know that we've worked very hard with the Department of Health and Social Services on this. We have a number of subcommittees and work groups. We've actually turned the curve, we believe, in bringing these kids back. We are particularly trying to work hard with the tribal providers. In order, 40% of the kids that are out of state are Alaska Natives, and so we're really working hard with them to develop their capacity to be able to serve people in their own system. Another focus area, if you move on, is the Beneficiary Projects Initiative. I'll let you read those slides for yourself, but basically the theory is this. It's not necessary for people to totally be dependent upon government-funded treatment programs. People can and do recover and are able to support each other in that recovery. And so these are trust-funded initiatives to try to help beneficiaries support each other and reduce their dependence on government-funded programs. Moving on to the next focus area, which is workforce development. Workforce development is absolutely ubiquitous across all of our focus areas, whether it's bringing the kids home, housing, justice initiatives. There is a serious shortage of people out there that are trained and able to provide these services, particularly in rural areas. So we're working hard with the university, Department of Labor and Workforce Development to really get a focus on these healthcare jobs. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and show this 8-minute video, if it's all right with the chair.
Please proceed.
Many people think that the homeless population is made up mostly of alcoholic single men who just don't want to work. But the reality is quite different. In Alaska, the average age of a homeless person is 9 years old. Alaska is one of the wealthiest states in the nation. Yet on any given night, approximately 3,500 Alaskans are homeless. People are at risk of homelessness when they have to choose between food, shelter, and other basic needs. All it takes is an unexpected medical bill to put someone on the street. Alaskans want to help. In a recent statewide public opinion survey, 90% agreed that we have a responsibility to help people who need a place to live. In Alaska, there is a gap between what low-income people can afford for housing and what housing actually costs.
Average cost of a new home in Anchorage, for instance, is around $329,000. That takes some income to support that kind of debt. Even in the rental market, if rents are $1,100, $1,200 a month for a single bedroom or a two-bedroom, and you're on disability or unable to work, for whatever reason, you're not going to be able to even afford rent. Who is homeless in Alaska?
They're barely making it on the salary that they have, and it doesn't take much. A car repair, an emergency, a medical emergency, they often don't have health insurance either. Any sort of additional expense, and they are pushed over the edge.
The fact is, about 45% of Alaska's homeless are families with children.
I lost my job. My mom passed away, I missed a lot of work, and it made it difficult. And so we ended up not being able to pay our bills, and so we ended up being homeless.
I was employed, working, I'm a single parent with three kids.
Sit down, let's do this homework together.
But how everything came crashing down is when I got sick at work, and I didn't have any leave, and there was nobody there to help me. It went from bad to worse. I lost my car, so then we didn't have transportation. I had no idea how I was going to get my children to school.
More than 3,000 school children were homeless or inadequately housed at some time during the 2005-2006 school year.
The average age of a homeless person is 9 years old. And we anticipate that even getting younger because the largest growing population are families with young children.
Homeless kids, if they're moving around a lot and they're not able to go back to the same school during the year, they don't do as well. Most of them are embarrassed about their situation. A lot of them don't like to talk about it, so they put some kind of protections around themselves.
Us being in the shelter, actually my youngest daughter has gotten, we got her first report card, she got all F's. It was very stressful for her. A lot of sleepless nights, didn't know what to do, didn't want to do her homework. She regressed really bad.
One of the things that you look at is that children who experience homelessness are four times as likely to have learning disabilities, to have significant cognitive delays.
Six is 12, and then two more sixes makes another 12, right?
Homeless children experience more mental health problems such as anxiety, depression, and withdrawal. Children without a home are also more likely to suffer from asthma, ear infections, stomach complications, and speech problems. About 14% of Alaska's homeless are severely mentally ill. Nana was homeless and slept on couches at her friend's house and sometimes on the street.
My mother died and I went through a mental breakdown and I got sick and lost everything. I had to forfeit my condo and my car. I functioned normally, I just had auditory hallucinations.
We have so many people that have a mental illness or chronic substance abuse problem, and they cycle in and out of the psychiatric hospital, in and out of jail for petty misdemeanors. If they are able to actually find a secure home and have the support services that they need and realize that over time they can actually remain stable in the community, then that's a life-changing experience for them.
Homelessness costs Alaska. Hospitalization, incarceration, and mental health treatment are just some of the costs a community must bear. The federal government provides the lion's share of housing assistance, but it does not adequately focus on the problems faced by those who are on the brink of homelessness or those who have already been forced out of their homes. How can we help? A major step is the Alaska Housing Trust.
Well, the Housing Trust is a strategy that many states and other jurisdictions are using now to try to take our existing housing programs and target them more directly to people that are homeless or at risk of becoming homeless.
In 2004, the governor created the Alaska Council on Homelessness to address the issue of homeless Alaskans and those struggling to stay in their homes. The council was composed of representatives of a number of state and federal agencies.
Within that group were eight commissioners, the head of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, HUD, and the lieutenant governor. We met numerous times and gathered testimony and information from a variety of participants to gain as much knowledge about the subject of homelessness throughout the state as we could. What we had arrived at was creating a housing trust to help support homeless issues and financing for homelessness.
More than 30 states across the nation have created successful housing trust funds. Housing trusts fund activities that reduce homelessness. Some of those activities include the construction of new housing, the purchase of existing housing, the rehabilitation of existing housing, the purchase of land, the establishment of a community land trust, and the modification of housing to make it more accessible. Housing trusts can also provide down payment and deposit assistance, rental assistance, tenant education, case management and counseling, financial counseling, and crisis intervention services. The Housing Trust will use proven strategies, like the program started in Seattle by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that provided $40 million to build 1,500 units of service-enriched housing. Strategies implemented through Housing Trusts in the Lower 48 have successfully addressed the issues faced by the homeless. They've also served the needs of those who work but are still at risk of homelessness. It's time to make it work in Alaska. By using innovation derived from successful pilot projects around the state and the nation, the Alaska Housing Trust seeks to create long-term affordable housing to reduce homelessness and to help those struggling to stay in their homes. The Alaska Housing Trust. Opportunity begins with a home.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might just make a couple of comments. The biggest thing that the Council on Homelessness discovered is that most of our housing dollars go to people at 70% of area median income and above. And there's two reasons for that. One is projects pencil out better if the tenants can put more money into the project through rent. And second, people that are homeless are usually homeless for a reason. They have mental health issues, substance abuse issues, domestic violence issues, health issues, disability issues. And the big difference between the strategies we're using now and what a housing trust is designed to do is the housing trust links support services directly to the housing. And just very quickly to give you a piece of information, in some of our Title I schools in Anchorage, in some classrooms, more than half the kids that start out in that classroom will be gone by the end of the year. 25% of the families the Gates Foundation served had kids that went to more than two schools during the course of a school year. We talk about failing schools, but I don't know how a school will ever educate kids that are moving from place to place like that. When the Gates Foundation evaluated their program at the end of 5 years, they had reduced that 25% of kids that moved more than twice during the school year down to less than 5% by providing these kinds of support services, employment counseling, and those services. We can reduce and eliminate much of the homeless problem in the state. How do we fund this? Our suggestion is that we look to the revenue that's generated by AHFC, that historically has been put into the general fund, and look at using some of those funds to fund a housing trust to deal with the homeless issues. The new council, since there are new commissioners, the new Council on Homelessness met last week. They have passed a resolution in support of creating a housing trust. That recommendation is now going to the governor, and we hope to be able to come back and present some more details to you at a future time. I also will mention that the Senate president has issued an invitation to the Gates Foundation to come to Alaska and present their findings firsthand. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jesse. Do we have any questions? The Senate Bill 51 that we have before us, is that supported by the trust?
Yes, we support many of the recommendations in there. There are a number of recommendations the trustees made that are not contained in the bill. We're continuing to work with the administration to try to get as many of those in there as possible, and we'll be working with the subcommittees on specific areas under their control.
So you do plan, there's a possibility that there may be amendments to this particular piece of legislation?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I do expect that the governor's amendments will contain amendments to this bill as well.
Any other questions? We are short of time. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you know, Alaska has a huge problem with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Are you able to get access, diagnostics, help for the clients you're serving?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, we're getting there. We're at the tail end of a five-year federal grant to address FAS issues, and that's been a tremendous asset in terms of getting, first of all, good evaluations and identification going. We're starting to get more and more prevention programs out there, but I will point out that that federal grant has ended, and unless that funding is replaced, then that program will actually be going away.
How much was that?
I believe the increment that's necessary is about $500,000.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for you on the distribution of veterans in Alaska. As I recall, the number, if you're in the, let's say you're a Vietnam veteran, the number of homeless people in that age group, that 50% of them are Vietnam veterans. Do you agree or disagree with that number?
Senator Huggins, I'm not sure about that number, so I don't have enough information to agree or disagree. I will say that anecdotally, we know that there are many veterans that are, in fact, homeless. And again, the most critical factor to them maintaining housing, if they get it, are support services, because many of them have issues beyond just the fact they don't happen to have a house.
Yeah, in a follow-up, we have one of the few domiciliaries that the Veterans Administration administers in Alaska. What's your feelings about the success rate of that particular facility?
Well, Senator Huggins, through the chair, it's very successful at the part of the continuum that it provides services in. But once you get through that, the big question for the long-term success of the individual is what do they go to from there? You know, we don't want people in there forever. That's when you have to get them in the community and build supports around them, or else they'll just cycle back through the domiciliary like they do other services.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah. But as I remember, that is the key component that's in that program, in that you go through and substance abuse and all those kinds of things that's the normal profile of the individual. But then there is an outreach that essentially places you someplace, gets you a job, and that's a continuation. I assume that's the sort of profile we're looking at for success, where you have a job, you have a place to live, it's subsidized, and then you factor out the subsidized living over time.
Yes, Senator Huggins, through the chair, that's correct. But it's that continuation of services where our system is very weak.
Okay. Thank
Final
you, Mr.
question
chair.
From, thank you, Senator Huggins. Final question from Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Chairman Huffman. Can you tell me what the 700 children that are, or youth anyhow, that are in treatment centers outside the state of Alaska, what does that cost the state?
I believe the cost of the state is between $35 and $40 million a year.
Thank you.
Thank you, and we probably have Mr. Jesse back when we have amendments and give the committee further opportunity for questions at that time. With that, we'll be adjourned.